Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, you know, obviously our show is called Strange Fruit Musings on Politics, Pop Culture, and Black Gay Life.
Yes.
You know, you and I are both black folk. We talk a lot. You know, we talk about gender, sexuality, and we talk about race. And primarily we talk about things as they relate to our fact. People of color, but specifically black folk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I often look to my friends of other backgrounds and other ethnicities and races to challenge me to be more thoughtful about what it means to be a person of color who is not black, right? Because that's our lived realities. And so I'm really, really always interested when people of color who have, you know, experiences of white supremacy and racism and just navigating the world, who aren't necessarily black, I'm really interested in hearing their stories and how they navigate the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are certainly people of color that we know who, you know, either are white passing or think they're white passing. You know, like, we all know people of color
yes.
who try to navigate the world as a white person, whether they look that way or not. Speaking of Stacey Dash, you know, I don't know if you heard, but Stacey Dash from Clueless was recently arrested.
Oh,
and apparently
yes.
he reported that on her police report, her arrest report, she lists her race as white.
No.
Now, anybody who's seen Clueless or saw her in Kanye's video, they know Stacey Dash is not a white woman. But nonetheless, she being there over there with 45 and really conservative, tries to navigate the world as a white woman, right? As if somehow mm-hmm. that would save her from anti-blackness. So all that to say, listeners, I'm really excited for today's guest, a writer who is an Asian American who wrote a piece for Vice.com for the identity portion titled Finding Asian Identity in a Black and White World. And so please welcome to the show today's guest, writer Ida Yu. Ida, how are you?
I'm great. It's nice to meet you all.
You as well. Thanks so much for being with us. So I want to hop right into it. You start your piece off by talking about the first time you felt ashamed at being Asian. You talk about something that happened. It was the first day of first grade. You were 6 years old. You were going to primarily white school, and something happened that gave you pause, that kind of you used to contextualize this conversation. Tell us that story, please, then tell us what led you to write this particular piece.
Definitely. First, I just want to go ahead and clarify, though, that the piece is actually titled Finding Asian Identity in a Black and White America and Not World. I just think that's an important distinction.
Thank you for the correction,
the
yes.
narrative. Yeah, but the story that kind of begins this essay is my first day, essentially, like, at first grade, and it was one of those Christian Scientist schools, so not a religion my parents practice at all, but like cheaper and still good education and all of that. And yeah, it was weird though, but it was very, very white. And when I came, like, I felt so shocked. I think it was the first time I'd ever been out of my comfort zone like that, because growing up, I had gone to Chinese-speaking preschools and kindergartens, and I never really needed to speak English. So I actually didn't even speak English that well, like at all, almost. And that was my very first day ever at first grade.
Yeah.
Mm. You mentioned in your essay, which I really, really loved, two important Supreme Court cases, right? Because throughout, there's a huge thread around how America, the backdrop of it, is this black and white binary. I often find this to be the case with my students who represent different racial identities, and we constantly are talking about white racism, white privilege, or, you know, black oppression, so on and so forth. And you mention in your piece two really distinct cases in the Supreme Court where Asian Americans end up becoming first defined not within the black and white binary, and then ultimately as non-white, yeah. falling under black. Can you tell our listeners a bit about those two cases?
Yeah. So in the first one is a Supreme Court case in 1854. And that was the first time that black and white were actually defined in, like, court ever. And so that year, a white man named George Hall, he had been convicted of murder. But that was because of the testimony of an eyewitness who happened to be Chinese American. And so Hall's lawyer, in like an attempt to get him out of the conviction, essentially pursued the argument that Chinese people didn't have rights, essentially, because they were ancestors of Indians. And he extrapolated there to mean Indians were Native Americans, which, you know, is not the case and is incredibly problematic. But he just relied on the fact that they were both from the continent of Asia. And since the worldview at the time of Native Americans was in such a way that they had no rights in court, he created this connection with the Chinese folks and said that they also possessed no rights in court. And then the Supreme Court actually took that case a step further to define the black-white binary and said that black means not white, and white must exclude all people of color. So inherently in the schematic of America at that point, everyone who falls outside of that binary doesn't exist.
Mm. In your piece, you say that being Asian in America means being a part of the most diverse, one of the most diverse racial groups. I mean, a lot of people just think that, you know, just like people think that Africa is a country, Doc, mm-hmm. and not a continent. People think that all Asians are the same. But you point out that unlike members of most other minority groups, that like considering your racial ethnicity, half Indonesian, half Chinese, that those racial makeups determine very little about the spaces and environments in which you exist. You point out, for example, that Asian Americans are the least likely of all people of color to live in homogenous neighborhoods. Meanwhile, white folk often reside in majority white neighborhoods. Black folk usually go to majority minority schools. You also say that Asian American folk have the largest income gap. And because of these things, this fluidity allows you all to either disappear into privilege or stand with the oppressed, right, to kind of navigate the world. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, some people try to do in proximity to whiteness or to be very decidedly aligned with the oppressed. Talk a bit more about that invisibility, that flexibility, and then also about how one makes a choice to do one or the other. And, you know, are there benefits to both, right? Sometimes it's a matter of survival to kind of go along and blend in with the majority, or is it? Yeah, so talk a bit about that, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think now there's much more awareness of the fact that the Asian diaspora is extremely expansive and covers, you know, innumerable countries. And even just being on opposite sides of the equator, like with my own heritage being Southeast Asian as well as East Asian, it greatly like affects your worldview. And I think few people know, for instance, like I'm Indonesian, like they don't know the state of poverty in Indonesia and the fact that the socioeconomic status of many Southeast Asians is very, very low. And that translates as well into America. When you think about things like access, like how did those immigrants get here? How did they manage to come? Was it through a war? Was it because they were refugees? Or is it more like the East Asian narrative because they already had monetary foundation? Were they set up? Could they, you know, set up a comfortable life once they got here? So that, of course, like is a big part of the spectrum, is the fact that within all the racial diversity of Asia as like a race, identity, and continent, you also experience this vast socioeconomic and classist, you know, stratification across those races. And, you know, it's not to say that certain groups are always going to be associated with certain socioeconomic statuses, but there are common trends and patterns that do begin to emerge when you look at the literature. So that goes to speak about the diversity in terms of like Asians as a whole and how we show up in America. But then when it comes into the more complicated space of navigating, you know, where you fall into this binary and where you might feel comfortable integrating in, you really start to look at environment, where you grew up, what did you have access to? Again, like, who were you around? Like, where did you go to school? Like, even if you lived around certain neighborhoods, were you able to go to a different school? Like, that was the case for me, for instance. I lived in a neighborhood that was primarily Latinx and Asian, but I got to go to school somewhere that was way, way, way more white. And so you begin to look at all these different factors that influence the formation of somebody's identity in a space, like in a country where that identity has been literally told and written, you know, into court cases that you don't exist. So we're in the space of liminality where we're literally defining what that identity means as we grow up. And I think my generation in particular was faced with that, unlike many, like we were in a very unique place basically to do that. And, you know, you get to choose where you integrate into. Sometimes, like, you know, when you're growing up, like it's hard to get made fun of. Like it's hard for all the white kids around you to tell you your food smells bad. You know, that's like the stereotypical trope. Or even smaller things to like make fun of you for why your dad prays at the Buddhist altar, says he like smells bad because of the incense he lights, like things like that. And like, so you want to integrate, you want to be more white because that's what you're around. Like you just want to fit in. It's a survival instinct, like you mentioned. Or in other cases, when you come up in lower income communities where it's mostly black and brown, you want to also belong, like whether that means like being out on the courts or like just being in the streets, like with everyone else, learning the same dances, like frequenting the same spaces. It's the same concept of just wanting to fit in because you don't know what your own identity looks like. And so trying to create that net of safety usually informs how individuals as Asian Americans form their own identity. But then outside of that, I think like we're reaching this new pivotal moment where Asian Americans, and I draw very heavily on scholar Jeff Chang's work. He's yes. also in the essay when I like think about this, where this current level of Asian American awareness allows us to basically choose which side we fall on. Like, are we going to fight against affirmative action? Like, there's so many cases, right, of Asian Americans kind of strike down affirmative action because they thought it didn't benefit them. But I think I just got a notification today, for instance, that the New York Times said a federal judge ruled that it doesn't actually discriminate against Asian Americans, which, like, I found to be the case the whole time. Yeah. But it's like, are we going to fight for affirmative action knowing that it's helping so many of our other historically marginalized communities, or are we going to stand, you know, on the opposite end of that and take the side of the privileged and be like, oh, well, you know, you're oppressing me because I have the means and access to things that would theoretically make me more capable. Yeah. So it is really about that choice. And I think just now as a community, we're starting to understand that and starting to be more progressive, at least in our culture and our art, and move beyond, you know, just conversations about representation.
No, certainly, certainly. I mean, and you talk about that. You talk about that in your piece about the pressure to conform to kind of whiteness and disassociate from things that culturally spoke to you, but how as you got through your teens, artists like Mitski, Sweatshop Boys, bringing the Asian American experience into indie and hip hop, and also Wong Fu Productions, and Korean Taco, and different chefs, and all these folks, and this incredible visibility of your nuanced culture really helped you get out of that dissociative behavior. Talk to our listeners about why visibility was important, especially for you in realms of the art world, food world. Why was this so important to you to kind of finally own your culture and come into your culture?
I think because it is really hard to even remotely form an opinion of your potential when you have never seen it done. Not even your dreams, but just of things that you could possibly ever be, you know, like spaces that like you think you could never, ever be a part of or reach. And whether that's through cultural norms, like, you know, having your parents tell you all the time, like, you need a real job, like, you can't pursue anything creative, like, you need to be studying this, this, and that. Like, my parents didn't do that, but that's a common trope too, right? Mm-hmm. And, like just being able to see for the first time ever in your life, like, your narrative or even someone who looks like you occupying a space that, like, you admire, I think that is so powerful. Yeah. Like, and I think it's weird, honestly, because, like, all my life I had never noticed I didn't have that until I started seeing it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like, just last week I watched The Farewell, and I don't really love Awkwafina because, like, of all the reasons. But the film itself, like, moved me so emotionally. And, like, in the theater I was watching, there were a number of other Asian Americans sitting, you know, throughout, like, and there were just so many scenes where literally every Asian American, I think, was just sobbing. Like, we were just sobbing in the theater, and it, like, was so weird because I don't react that way to movies, really.
Yeah.
Like, I'll, like, shed one tear, but, like, like, I was breaking down because I'm, like, seeing this portrait of my grandma, basically.
Yeah.
Like, going through something, like, my family acting a certain way that all my friends growing up and even friends I have now would still be like, oh, that's weird. Like, why would they act that way? And this film is treating like it's the norm. You know, this film is showing me that, like, oh, well, like, actually, it's not weird. Like, it's just how this experience is. And I think, like, finally having the space to be able to explore that is really, really captivating. I don't know. It's very interesting. And it comes with all these caveats of, like, oh, but we should also be thinking forward. We should also be trying to be more progressive. Like all of the, you know, nuances of that, it totally comes with. But I think very few people, like outside of the Asian American community, sometimes understand, like, we're not even close to getting most of America to understand what we are. Yeah. Like some of the comments on the Vice piece when it went viral, like, because they shared it on their social feed, and like some of those comments, like, that these usually men were leaving, usually white men too, were like so incredibly racist.
Yeah.
Like, it was like one of them was like, "Let the lights dim some." I'm like, "What?"
They said what? Ugh.
Yeah, I'm like, what?
Wow.
Like, my boyfriend saw that comment. I didn't even see it. He was like, "Oh, I want to fight him."
Okay, wow. Yes. I mean, they can be ridiculous. White races are just absolutely ridiculous. I wanted to ask you, toward the end of your piece, right, because you talk about Chang's work and how Jeff Chang's work has meant a lot to you, especially in terms of art, hip-hop, and Asian-American experience, and you say that Asian-American identity doesn't rest with assimilation, right, or appropriation. Talk and give some advice to our listeners, some of whom might be listening and needing some kind of advice about how powerful it can be if one can chart their own life and define their own culture and the way in which they experience it. Give advice maybe to our listeners about how they can tap into that culturally relevant power that they have.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most difficult things. The most difficult things to navigate as just any community within this in-between in America. And one of the things that really resonated with me that Jeff Chang said is that, I'll use his example, like in hip hop, there's this concept of the radical welcome. And the idea is you can be welcomed into the cipher, you know, as long as you are paying your respect and doing your due diligence. Like, if you're welcomed into a house, he said, like, you just don't go and, like, f*** it up. Like, you don't go and trash it. You acknowledge the people who brought you there, and you're grateful. And I think that's, like, the foundation for all of this. When you want to build on creating something that is uniquely yours or feels inspired by, like, maybe influences from other cultures, which is natural when you're Asian American because you grew up only having exposures oftentimes to other cultures, contemporary cultures. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's drawing all of that in and understanding and being extremely thoughtful and intentional and paying homage to where all of those things came from, who are the creators, who are the founders, and being honest with that and not trying to overstep and take credit and perform. Like, that's the issue, for instance, with Awkwafina, is that she's performing. You know what I mean? Like, whereas, like, if you're just yourself and that's who you are as a consequence of your environment, like, nobody is going to fight you for your story. Like, that's just your story.
Absolutely.
And then within that, like, you pay that respect and then you go ahead and you try to contribute in some way. You know, you find ways you give back. You find ways that you create without taking away. And it's not impossible. It's just very hard. And I think a lot of people, you know, feel overwhelmed by that or, you know, shy away from wanting to do all that work. But that's all it is. It's just a lot of work. And that's why it's really hard to navigate the space as someone who's Asian American, is because you can tell your own story as much as you want. But sometimes, like, you're just influenced by things in your environment growing up. Like my friend Ada, she makes really incredible work. And she's a Chinese American jeweler who's from SF. And she, you know, grew up near Hunters Point in SF. She has, like, a very distinct environment that she grew up in that influenced her, and she draws some of those aspects into her work today, into her jewelry. And people who don't know that story also, like, will just flag that as being appropriation all the time without understanding. So I think there is just, like, a really distinct give and take that happens where, like, everyone needs to understand that everyone has their own story, and it's about paying respect to that. And if we can all just keep trying to bring that intention into what we do, then it is possible to keep creating this new culture.
I love it. You end your piece with this, and I'll read it to our audience. You say, quote, "As I grow into my mid-20s, I'm discovering that for me, finding Asian American identity means confronting with care and humility the in-between of race in America. It means seeing my position not as one defined by lack, but as one rich with potential for collaboration, solidarity, and giving back. And as we, as a community, start telling our stories in increasingly amplified volumes, I hope that this emerging orientation helps us recognize the power that we possess in defining who we are and who we want to be. So I think that really sums up. I mean, it was a wonderfully enlightening piece for me. I mean, certainly lots of history that I didn't know about, but then also a lot of cultural context. And I just really appreciate you challenging, me as a host of this show to think more about other folk of color and how they navigate the world. But I'm sure that there are lots of other Asian American folk who really appreciated you telling their stories through your words. And so we wish you the best of luck. Thanks for making time for us, and please be well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. To support the work we do on Strange Fruit, visit donate.strangefruitpod.org or look in our show notes for a link. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
All right. Many thanks to Ida Yu for that wonderful, wonderful and insightful conversation about being Asian in a Black and white America.
I loved it because oftentimes, like, I'm teaching a racism, sexism class right now.
Yes, which I really enjoy, by the way.
Yes, I'm really enjoying it. I'm having so much fun. But often, a lot of the readings that I compile for the course deal with this white-black binary specifically. I had to really, really seek out, readings that had to do with sexism and racism when it came to Arab folk, Asian folk.
Yes, Latinx folk.
And Latinx folk. They just are few and far between. And so I really appreciated talking with her and learning so much about someone's experience of trying to kind of fit in this binary and how detrimental that is.
You obviously have students in your class, that class in particular, that are not Black or white, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that those students who are people who are not Black or white, right, can feel lost in those discussions? And especially when you're talking about things like oppression and but relate them to in terms of Blackness, and they feel oppression too, but it's obviously a different way. So why is it important to you to make sure, I mean, with an intentional to feel like, to be like, I gotta find some stuff about other cultures?
Yeah.
Because most teachers would just do the Black and white effect.
No, definitely that. And I think that there are in many courses that are like that, where they just see themselves either identifying heavily with the Black aspects or the white aspects. And for me, I just didn't do that. I mean, I have multiracial courses and students from all different types of walks of life. And I want to treat what their experiences are just as valid as what's going on in terms of the white and Black binary. And I feel, and I don't know, maybe it's from me growing up in Ann Arbor, it was really, really racially diverse. So Asian folk, Latinx folk, Arab folk. Oh, yeah, never. Yeah. You know, I mean, and then living in Chicago, living in Philly. And so it just wasn't this kind of everything is Black or everything is white, everybody's oppressed or everybody's privileged. There was a lot of nuance and a lot of different types of circumstances that people found themselves in racially in the U.S. So I just was really trying to be cognizant of it, but it still wasn't enough. So I'm glad we got to talk to her.
I love that.
To get some clarity.
The first time I realized, so after high school, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and did like an internship. And that was like the first time I was in a city that wasn't majority white, but also with a majority Black, right? And so I was like, oh my gosh, so you got indigenous folk, you got Latinx folks, Mexican in particular. Like, it was just so many people, Asian folk, people of color, but they weren't Black, but they also, like, weren't white folks.
Yes.
And it was so cool. Like, I would go to McDonald's, and it'd be like cheeseburgers with tomatillo salsa. And
yes.
I'm like, oh, snap. You know, like, you know, everything had, and that was not, you know, here they'd be like, what is this green stuff? You know, in Kentucky, because everything's, you know, accustomed to good old-fashioned, regular, quote-unquote, regular folk, but they're, it's part of their culture, like, everywhere you went, Burger King, you know, the breakfast sandwiches had tomatillo salsa, had some salsa verde. Like, that was just a part of those kind of extra flavors, you know, ethnic flavors are part of, you know, the even the fast food culture. So it felt really cool to be in a city. I'm like, dang, like, there's cities that aren't just Black and white. So that felt really good.
I just love that. I love that you were in New Mexico living and you were so young.
I loved it. I lived it up. At the time, I didn't appreciate. But it was really cool because I got my activist chops sharpened. Like, when I was there, they were going through this protest with the Sandias, which are these mountains that are sacred to indigenous folk. Mm-hmm. And the government was trying to put a highway through the Sandias. Ugh. And so this is like an old, you know, sacred land for indigenous folk, but the government was trying to put their highway through it, and we want to protest, and it was just really, really cool. I went to, like, a sweat lodge, which is, like, literally, it's like a, for lack of a better term, like a tent that indigenous folk, Like there's a
like a heat. Sauna.
Yes. And like so the goal is to stay there as long as you can. And it's like a very therapeutic spiritual experience. But you go in there, you sweat, so you can't take it no more.
Yes.
I experienced so much. I went to the corn harvest in Santa Fe. I experienced so much, but at the time I was like 18, 19, didn't realize.
Yeah, you were just like, this is my life.
Like, yeah,
and
I'm
yeah.
like, if I only got my parents' house and I can get my own room, and I can, you know, smoke weed, or, you know, whatever. Like, you know, I thought I was doing it at that age for the first time. But yes, I would love to go back and visit Albuquerque again. That's always in my bucket list of things. Did you hear, Doc, there's going to be two new Little Mermaid remakes coming out?
Oh, yes. One is the with
ABC
the...
Live.
Okay.
When one's going to be a movie, like a live action movie.
Yeah.
So the ABC Live version has Queen Latifah playing Ursula.
I love it.
The movie version, I think they're going to do Melissa McCarthy from Girlfriends. Bridesmaids.
Oh, my God. I love that too.
Both good choices.
Yes.
But, you know, I think they say that Lizzo was actually rooting for the job, but it's going to go to McCarthy. And she's very funny. But I love that Latifah's doing Ursula for the ABC Live. Shaggy, Mr. Bombastic, he's doing the crab.
Oh my God! For the ABC version. I remember him. Yes. Oh my God!
So yeah.
I love
so anyway,
it.
I thought I just wanted. I know you're a fan.
I'm a huge fan of Little Mermaid.
Can you sing an excerpt of?
I'm not gonna say no, because you always use me like that. No,
I don't. I would do it except I'm under the weather. But no, what's the poor unfortunate souls? Or what song do you like?
No, my favorite. I think my favorite song from Little Mermaid is again. When she's in her cove, where she's collected all of the kind of things that people have thrown in the ocean, right? Because it was also this, it was also a film that really tried to spotlight how we were polluting the oceans with human stuff. And so she has this cove where she's collected forks and knives and candlesticks
and
silver and all these kinds of things. And I guess we're supposed to believe that they're from ships and things that got shipwrecked and stuff. And so she's like singing part of your world. That's my favorite.
Okay, how does that go?
No, I'm not.
But how
I'm
does
not
it
doing,
go? Not, what's the first two notes?
I'm not singing it. No, no.
I guess I gotta wait for the live version.
She's like, look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Okay, that's it.
Don't do a little bit more, please.
No,
okay.
No.
Listen, give it up. Okay? Listen.
You are
it's,
so
it's like,
it's mean.
Like the voice of, no, it's like the voice of angels.
Girl, you try it.
So this is what I'm going to do.
You know
though.
That I think I can sing, and
no,
I know
you,
that I really can't sing,
good.
But
so
you always make
do,
fun of me.
When ABC version airs, we're going to have a watch party at your house.
Yes.
Me, you, Missy, Mystical,
yes.
Your wife. We're going to invite MJ. And
okay.
We're like John Mace, the old intern.
Yeah.
And so we can all have our popcorn. And when it's time for the parts, you're going to sing.
I am going to sing.
I'm going to cheer you on. Coach,
my other
Coach
favorite
can come
song,
too if you want.
My other favorite song is with Ursula.
Okay.
But I feel like, I can't remember it right now, but I think it's Poor Unfortunate Souls is hers.
Okay. Well, so next week.
In pain.
Yes.
In need. What? This one wanting to be thin out. That one wants to get the girl. And do I help them? Yes, I do.
Look at
yes,
you.
Yes, I love her.
Encore.
I love Ursula. Do you understand? She's everything to me.
Your voice is getting so much stronger over the years.
You know what? You know what? You tried it. You know what?
You see how he
encourages me and then like completely makes fun of me?
I've got some good news for the two of us.
Okay, what is it?
So.
What?
Well, number one, this is good news for me.
Okay.
There's a study that says that eating ice cream for breakfast may improve your mental performance. Okay, this was a Japanese website that the story professor Yoshiko Koga of... It's a university. It's spelled K-Y-O-R-I-N.
Okay.
University in Japan.
Yes.
They said eating ice cream can improve your alertness and mental performance. So...
I love it.
You know, I have my favorite ice cream. I eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it's obviously what makes me so smart. What's your morning routine?
Do you eat a peanut butter chip ice cream in the morning?
Listen, I had two bowls last night.
No.
Kept me up half the night, but nonetheless...
No, no ice cream for breakfast.
You know, I eat anything for breakfast. You know, Doc, you know my eating habits are
and
kind of
trashy.
And
you do like evening meals for breakfast as well. I'll be like, what did you have for breakfast? What did you have for breakfast, Jay? And you'd be like, oh, just some fried pork chops
I'm like,
and some mashed potatoes.
Steak and potatoes.
I'm like, it's 9 a.m.
Well, you know, a lot of people do breakfast for dinner, and I do dinner for breakfast.
Yes, no, it's so true.
So
it
what's
so
your
funny.
Morning routine? It's just a regular, like, you like your Starbucks coffee.
I love yes,
iced coffee.
That's some
egg white bites.
Yeah,
so you have a nice healthy.
I was getting egg white bites, but now I'm just sick of them because I've been eating them like every day. But they're egg whites with roasted red peppers in them, and I think green peppers too.
See, but no meat, no pork, no meat.
No. Well, first of all, no pork for me. Period. No. Period. And I just gave up beef probably like 8 months ago.
No,
I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
So I'm only doing like chicken, turkey. And I'm not really not that much turkey, but chicken, you know? Yeah. So I'm almost done with the chicken
aspect.
You
like a slice shrimp every once in a while.
I love shrimp. Now, that's just never going
to
go away.
But you won't do a lobster or a crab, which is so interesting to me.
I'm terrified of lobster and crab. Yeah. I'm terrified. And I'm also not doing crawfish as well.
Yeah, crawfish is not
what I have what is known as emotional allergies certain foods.
Yes.
I'm not a fan. So no crab cakes, no crab, no lobster.
Yes. I like how you put that because, you know, when you go places and tell people, like, you never forget that I was working at...
What?
You know, I was working at the Cheesecake Factory many years ago, and, you know, you had to go through, like, this extensive two-week training. You got to learn every menu item, and then at the end, you have to taste all the food.
Okay, yes.
But Cheesecake Factory, I don't eat what? Cheesecake.
Yeah, no, you don't eat cheesecake, and you don't eat pasta.
Yeah, okay, two of the staples.
Yeah, you don't eat pasta.
But at least I'll try pasta, but I will not try cheesecake.
Because you'll eat spaghetti as long as it has, like, meatballs or meat sauce.
Yes. So, of course, they end this training, and they're like, okay, and everybody looks forward to the day when you go taste, like, 100 different cheesecakes. And so, of course, you know, they want you to taste every item to describe it to your guests, and so you can't just say, like, I don't eat cheesecake. And people are like, what you mean? And then they're like, okay, well this is your job. You're going to eat it today. So I kind of like lied and said I was allergic to cheesecake. I'm not sure that that's an ingredient by itself. I'm not allergic to cheese or cake, but I'm allergic to cheesecake. You know, so I love that you lie about being allergic to seafood because if you just tell people you don't like it, they try to press you to eat it.
Definitely. They'll be like, oh, you don't know what you're missing out on, and you've never had lobster, and oh, my God.
Well, they're trying to sneak it, you know, like, you would love it. Into your food. And...
Yeah, and it's like, again, I don't have that kind of personality. You're not going to work me. You're not going to, if I say no, that's what it means. I'm not bending. I'm not, I'm not that personality. And so I'll just be like, no, I'm deathly allergic.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll say deathly.
Yeah, basically.
You know, so then people will just pay it and be like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Yeah. But even foods I'm not allergic to, if someone in the room asked about it, remember that one time it was me, you, and Jason Walker.
A few weeks ago, yeah.
It was me, you, and Jason Walker.
Yes.
And you were cooking for me and Jason Walker. Yeah, and this
you know,
is what
I used to love to go through your cabinets and put things together so I could get some kind of Asian-inspired chicken dish. But you had some peanuts in your pantry, so I'm going to throw some peanuts in it. So
Jay says when he's cooking, he says, Jason Walker, do you have any nut allergies, peanuts specifically, you know, allergies? And so Jason Walker's like, oh, no, And so then, like, a couple minutes later, I started getting scared, and I was like, why did you ask that?
Yeah,
you know,
why are you,
what do you mean, why are you asking him that? And you were like, Doc, I don't even want to hear it as much peanut butter cups. Reese's peanut butter cups.
And peanut butter
jelly sandwiches.
And cashews. And the peanuts in your daggone pantry. You know, but you do it. I'm like, girl. Don't even ask me.
Yeah, they just certain foods give me anxiety. I don't know where I developed all these aversions from, but yeah.
Oh, goodness. Okay, we got to go.
Okay.
But I want to tell you about this last study right quick. Speaking of things that are your personality, there's a study from 2014 that says that people who swear have a healthier verbal ability than people who don't swear. And people often think that if you cuss a lot, that you have, you know, low intellectual...
Yeah,
low,
limited
you know,
vocabulary,
you
yes.
You use $20 words. But it's like, really, those of us who curse a lot have a more extensive language. Would you agree with that kind of thing?
Oh, I completely agree with
you. You got a potty
mouth.
As
an avid cursor.
You got a potty mouth.
I know, I really do. I've been better. I've gotten better over the years. But, yeah, for the most part, I curse all the time. But I just was, both my parents, they cursed around me. Never at me, but around me. And they always did it for emphasis. So I never saw curse words as, like, these bad words.
Yeah,
or words
that, with each other, yeah.
Yeah, or words that they should avoid. I remember I was playing a video game at my dad's house, you know, because my parents were divorced when I was young. And so I would go to my dad's house every other weekend, spend time with him. And I think I was playing either Duck Hunt or Power Pad, like on Nintendo.
Oh, yeah.
Remember
original,
Nintendo?
Original Nintendo.
Okay. And so I lost. And I think I was like, you know, yeah, like I said something. And my dad comes out from the kitchen and he's like, what'd you say, Munch? And I said, something. And he's like, that's funny as hell. And I'm like, oh, my God. He just fell out and started laughing.
That's like an ABC sitcom.
So once my parents kind of did that green light for me, then I started cursing at school. I started cursing at my peers. You know, like I was playing this, I don't even know what her name was, but we played in tetherball. And she, like, won. And I was kind of surprised and upset that she did. And I was like, and she was like gloating about it or something. And I was like, well, you ain't nothing but ass kids anyway. Or something
I
said. So I had to go to the principal's office.
Well, you know what happened to me? The first time I said the N-word towards my cousin, I got my mouth washed out with soap. So
literal soap.
Yeah, I took a bar of soap and my mother put your tongue out. Your mother washes your mouth out with soap.
But isn't soap poisonous?
It's not poisonous. You know, no. I mean, this wasn't like no industrial.
I mean, how did you get it out of your mouth?
No, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't saturate your mouth. You basically just, I mean, think about if you shampoo your hair and you actually get some soap in your mouth, you spit it out.
I get you. Just rinse
it.
But
yes, it's somebody gonna kill you, child. It's not, you gonna suck on them hard soap.
I've never met anyone who got their mouth washed out with soap.
Oh, yeah, child, that's an old back thing. Google it.
I mean, I've heard of it. I've just never met anyone in person.
Child, my mother, the word L-I-E was a cuss word. You couldn't say lie or liar. You couldn't say shut up. Okay, you couldn't say, you had to say be quiet. You could not call someone you're a liar. You have to say you're telling a tale. How silly and ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
Silly ridiculous.
I actually think that's kind of cute.
See, no, it's not.
Because I'm like, what do you say if
someone... Is that cute when you're a black man child in the 80s and 90s trying to be cool and can't even cuss right?
You're okay? Like, you're telling a tale. I come here.
Child, I used to cuss in middle school. My friends were like, oh, Jason, don't even do it, choir boy. Like,
oh, my God, that is so cute.
It's not any of this works, you know?
That
anyway,
is so cute. That's really
but we
cute.
Have... clearly a more emotional intelligence vocabulary. Anyway, we're out of time, y'all. I'm gonna go drink some more hot tea, get this voice together for next week. Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.